Hi, everyone. Welcome to a very special pre-draft podcast here at FantasyGuru.com, a special edition of the FantasyGuru.com podcast, if you will. I am FantasyGuru.com managing editor Joe Dolan, and today I'm pleased to welcome on Fran Duffy, who is the video content manager for PhiladelphiaEagles.com. But before I get into talking about Fran, introducing Fran, I just want to remind everybody that right now is a great time to subscribe to FantasyGuru.com. We haven't raised the price in 20 years, and I assure you this year, you're going to get your money's worth. We are rebuilding FantasyGuru.com from the ground up. It is a huge, huge project that's going to involve new stat databases, a new look for the website, a much more easy-to-use website. We are in the process of doing that right now, planning on rolling everything out in time for the football season. But meanwhile, and kind of in conjunction with that, we're preparing for the football season, and we're preparing for the NFL draft, which is in about a week, depending on when you're listening to this, maybe over the weekend. You're maybe as little as a day before the draft, but we're recording it a week before the draft. And right now, I have the pleasure of being with a guy I view as one of the foremost experts on the draft. And if you don't know Fran, I suggest you get to know him, and hopefully this is a gateway to knowing Fran, because he's really awesome at what he does. He is the video content manager at PhiladelphiaEagles.com. He is the host of the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast, the Journey to the Draft podcast, which he does for Philadelphia Eagles, and the College Draft podcast with the king of all media, Ross Tucker. Fran is all over all of these rookies, and he doesn't cram. He's studying these guys for years. Fran, it's good to talk to you, and welcome to the podcast.
Joe, thank you very much. That was as good of an intro, I think, I've ever received, so thank you.
No problem. Fran, you can follow him on Twitter, by the way, at fduffy3. And Fran is really the most knowledgeable guy I have on any of these prospects. And I'm always G-chatting Fran, asking him what he thinks about these guys, defensive guys, guys who I never saw before. Because I know, Fran, if there's a guy who has any sort of talent, you've watched these guys. And just to introduce you to the people, what's your background here? When did you start scouting? When did you start becoming, I guess the term is, a draft nick? How did you get into this?
Yeah, well, I've been in the draft for, you know, since I was a kid. Yeah, and really, I can remember the days when the draft was on the weekend, and me and my brother would sit on the couch, and for 48 hours straight, we would watch all seven rounds, and we'd know all the names. We'd have all the magazines out. We were all about it, and you know, growing up and playing Madden and getting into the franchise mode and team building, all that stuff always really intrigued me. I've read so many books that go on the inside of NFL teams and NFL front offices, and really I'm all about the team building aspect of professional sports. And so it's a really fascinating topic. I've always loved football. It really started, I would say, for the Donovan McNabb era of Philadelphia. I grew up in Philadelphia as an Eagles fan, so obviously very, very happy with where I've ended up here. Very, very lucky. And, you know, I went to Temple University. When I got there, I got into writing. I was a broadcasting major, but I got into doing some writing. Actually, my first gig was writing for KFFL.com. I did some fantasy writing, and, you know, before they kind of went through their whole shebang. And so I got started there, wrote for Yahoo and Pro Football Weekly, and was kind of blurbed all over the place, a couple magazines as well, and really started getting heavy into writing about the draft. At the same time, this would have been 2006, Al Golden arrived at Temple as the football coach and saw an ad in the paper for a video assistant job with a football team, went, answered it, was a student assistant for Al Golden's first year. About halfway through the season, and I was a student assistant from spring ball, practice one in the spring, up until this point, it was about 10:30 at night on like a random Thursday night. Al pulls me into his office and he goes, "Fran, you know, you're a student now. Do you think you can be the full-time, the head video coordinator? The coaches all believe in you. Do you know, is that something that you'd be interested in? Because we're going to make a change after the season." I said, "Coach, absolutely." Now, I hadn't had my degree. I had only been doing it for, you know, 7 months as a student. And he gave me a great opportunity. The coaches there were awesome. And so for 5 years, his whole time at Temple on North Broad Street, I got to sit. I got to watch practice every day and watch games every day, watch tape. Work with the coaches on all their coaching tapes and practice tapes and technique tapes. And so I really started to learn the game as much as I could. You know, I wish I had done more, but tried to soak up as much as I could during my time with those guys. And every position coach, you know, working with them to make their teach tapes every single offseason, and you know, watching tape and learning how to break down tape with our assistant coaches and our GAs to scout opposing teams and know all the different things that they look for. It's definitely something that really helped me pick up the bug and helped me learn more about what I do now with the Philadelphia Eagles.
Well, certainly you took advantage of an opportunity, and I think that's one thing that a lot of people who are in this industry, podcasting, you know, tweeting, writing about football, whether it be fantasy or just football in general, I think you just have to open the door for yourself and try to just take advantage of every single opportunity. But obviously, you've been afforded a fantastic opportunity that not a lot of people are able to take advantage of. You learn the game from high-level coaches. But one thing I want to get to on this podcast is, if there's somebody out there who's listening to the pod, just as a big football fan, big draft fan, wants to learn the game a little bit better, some little tips maybe that you can give people to just watching guys, things to look for. And that was kind of the focus when I pitched this podcast to you. It was more, all right, we're going into the NFL draft, and we're a fantasy site, so I want to focus on the skill positions and traits you look for from those positions. And we're still going to do that.
Sure.
But to just kind of jump into things, we would just be completely mistaken if we didn't talk about, to start, the quarterback trades at the top of the NFL draft. And initially, for those listening, Fran and I had scheduled this for Wednesday, April 20th, and we moved it back because there was going to be a ton of traffic down here in South Philly, given the Phillies played and the Flyers played, and we just moved it back one day. And it's a good thing we did, because Fran told me yesterday we would have had to cancel anyway, because there was a trade in this very building. I'm actually in the NovaCare complex right now. There was a trade in this building that's going to bring a quarterback, ostensibly, to the Philadelphia Eagles. And last week, the Los Angeles Rams made a trade that's going to, ostensibly, bring a quarterback to Los Angeles. And it seems very obvious right now, Fran, in whatever order these quarterbacks go in, it's going to be Cal's Jared Goff and Carson Wentz of North Dakota State going 1 and 2. I like them both as prospects. I think you like them both as prospects. And they're still very different prospects, though. From my perspective, I think Wentz is more of the wow type of talent. He's the guy. He's a really good – Howie Roseman used a pizza analogy yesterday.
Yeah.
Carson Wentz is a really good slice of pizza. It looks good, and when you start eating it, it tastes really good. And you're enticed by it right away. You want more of it. I think Jared Goff might be more of the – 5-course gourmet meal where it takes a little bit more time and you want to savor it and you want to see how the pieces fit together. And while both are great and a lot of times you're going to prefer the pizza, they are different prospects. And for fans of LA, for fans of Philadelphia who are listening to this, I wanted to compare and contrast Jared Goff and Carson Wentz to start off. And we can start with Jared Goff. I think he's the guy who a lot of people are projecting right now to go number one to the LA Rams. Michael Silver has been saying it's going to be Goff. I think Adam Schefter recently reported that they're leaning to Jared Goff out of Cal. 3-year starter, 6'4", 215 pounds, good athlete, maybe not a great mover. But what is it that a team like the LA Rams or the Eagles is going to like about Jared Goff as a prospect?
Well, Joe, the first thing that you want to look at, and you touched on it early in that question, was what are the traits you're looking for? And we'll touch on this as we get through every position. But the main thing that you want to look at, if this is something you're interested in doing moving forward, you want to be able to watch the NFL, see what the traits are that help players excel at their specific positions in the National Football League. So, you know, because college football and the NFL are two very different games in the way they're played, mainly because of the hash marks and just the general speed of the game. Now, the big thing with Jared Goff is, look, he's a 3-year starter. He started 37 games. Every game he played in, he started for the Golden Bears. Really quick release. He's got good feet in the pocket. He's got really light feet. I think he's got a good arm. He shows good touch to all areas of the field. Some of the throws that he made this year were some of the best throws I've seen any quarterback make over the last couple of years. I mean, some of the throws he made against Arizona State, some of the throws that he made against UCLA, just outstanding over the last couple of years. He's improved every year that I've watched him. I've watched him going from his freshman year to his sophomore to his junior year. They were 1-11, I believe, his first year as a starter. It was just a poor football team around him, and he really helped to turn that program around. So you have to give him a lot of credit. And, you know, the physical tools are good. You know, he's got a good arm. Again, I mentioned that quick release. In that offense, he played in an air raid offense under Sonny Dykes. Wasn't asked to do a ton at the line of scrimmage or to in terms of reading defenses, but in terms of projecting his physical traits, I think that they project pretty well. You know, you've seen some comparisons to guys like Matt Ryan, and for good reason, because he's got those feet. He's got the ability to withstand pressure. I can remember one touchdown throw that he had against Texas where he faced interior pressure. He stepped up into the pocket. Pressure came right at his face. He rolled to his left and on the run hit his receiver rolling in that direction on the money for a touchdown. That's the kind of play you like to see. And whenever I'm watching quarterbacks at the college level, you really want to try and find plays where, you know, I watch the NFL all year round and really mainly, obviously, in the fall. You know, during football season, I'm watching the NFL every single day and on tape. I'm watching because I produce Eagles Game Plan, which is a show that's shown on NBC10 here in Philadelphia as well as on PhiladelphiaEagles.com. I do a ton of X's and O's, all 22 content. So I'm looking at the Eagles, I'm looking at their opponents, try and bounce around the league when I can, but mainly the Eagles, their opponents, and who their opponents are playing. So I'm watching these NFL quarterbacks every single week, and you see pocket movement, you see anticipation, you see tight window throws, you see consistent repetitive accuracy, you see all these traits that really mean something, and arm strength does mean something too. I haven't mentioned it yet, but that means something as well. You're looking for all those traits, and do these prospects exhibit those traits during their time in college?
And Jared Goff, when I was saying that he's more of maybe the five-course meal that's supposed to be – you're supposed to experience all of those courses.
Which, by the way, I love food analogies, so let's just try and keep that going.
Yeah, okay. I'll let me try. I think this was the only one I came up with before the podcast. Okay. But I feel like he's a prospect that you start to get, if you will, a little more the more you watch him. And at first, maybe you're not blown away by the traits – but the more you watch Jared Goff, you start to understand how his game makes sense, if you will. It starts to come together. And I think that's a lot different than Carson Wentz, as I said. But does it concern you with Jared Goff that he wasn't, quote-unquote, a winner in college? He played on bad teams,
yes,
let's be frank.
No question.
Does that concern you at all? Because it's a vastly different than Carson Wentz. Because we're going to talk about the level of competition,
right,
when it comes to Wentz. But Wentz beat up on that competition. Jared Goff, let's be frank, got his ass kicked.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is that, and everybody that, you know, in draft Twitter, the joke is, you know, hashtag QB wins with a Z. Yeah, and
yes,
it's not, look, winning percentage is obviously something you want to see for a quarterback. And I believe Carson Wentz was 20-3 during his career as a starter. You know, that's obviously something you want, but there are plenty of quarterbacks that have had a ton of success at the college level. You know, Tim Tebow, Jason White, Timmy Chang. You know, we'll go on. Numbers you can get. And this is actually something I've been working through over the last few months. Through this whole process, and this is with everything, numbers can tell any story you want, and to a point, film can tell any story you want, because, you know, if you say Christian Hackenberg is a super, super accurate thrower, I can go and find five plays where he had just beautiful dime throws downfield and show you those five plays. And you may walk away saying, man, he's one of the most accurate quarterbacks in the draft. When in reality, of course, we know that that's not the case. And I like Christian Hackenberg more than pretty much anybody you're going
to
find.
We will get to that.
We'll get to that. But, you know, to me, it's all about putting everything in context that you find. And when you look at numbers, yeah, Jared Goff obviously didn't have the winning percentage that a Carson Wentz had. But, you know, you look at some of the other traits that he had, and I talked about his decision-making on third down and in the red zone. I mean, he was outstanding. You know, his completion percentage, one of the things I've started to do starting this year was look at all of a quarterback's passes on third down. And Jared Goff was one of the best in the country at that this past year in terms of the draft prospects. You know, and he had one interception that I charted on third down. He only had one red zone interception in his entire 3-year career, and it came this past season. So when it comes down to crunch time and in those must-have moments, he's a very efficient quarterback. And it's something that I think a lot of NFL teams are really intrigued by.
And that's why I think Jared Goff is just fascinating to me, because he might not have the elite physical traits of a guy like Carson Wentz. And before we move on, let's get to Carson Wentz, because as I said, this is the guy who I think if you watch him right away and you just kind of have a basic idea of what you're looking for, you see a big guy who can move, who can sling the ball. I think one term our guy Greg Cosell loves to use is torque.
Yes.
And I think Carson Wentz defines that, the way he throws the ball with velocity. He uses his entire body to throw the ball. And you have to try to isolate, I think, and I want to ask you about this, the fact that he played for North Dakota State. Because I watched more Carson Wentz before I came over here today. And this is a guy who, on film, looks bigger than his offensive lineman. And that is just a really weird thing to see when you're scouting a guy to be an NFL quarterback.
Yeah.
And how do you isolate that?
Well, our friend Greg Cosell will say that it's not where you did it. It's not who you did it against. It's how you did it. And when you look at a guy like Carson Wentz and you see those physical traits, and the physical traits I think are good. You know, and I think that it's interesting that I think the narrative has changed a little bit on Carson Wentz over the course of the last year. You know, I think his arm, a lot of people questioned his arm, we'll say in September, October. And I understood that because there are some times where you see the deep ball die a little bit on the back end. He does have a good arm. His arm is not to the level of a Christian Hackenberg or, you know, of a Brock Osweiler, or some of these guys that have come out over the course of the last couple of years where they just have a cannon. He's got a strong arm. He can make every throw you need. But people did question that. He's a big kid. The accuracy on the deep ball was the question. The thing that always has stood out to me about Carson Wentz, and this is something we definitely talk about, when you talk about pro-style plays, you know, those NFL-type throws, I saw a lot of that from Carson Wentz. And it wasn't just the NFL throw, it was the NFL situation. You know, and I can remember a play against Weber State, and this is one of my favorite plays. It's not often, you know me, Joe, it's not often that I will watch a quarterback and think, you know what, my favorite play from this guy was a run play. Because it's not often that I say that, okay?
Oh, certainly.
One of my favorite plays from Carson Wentz was, I believe it was a 26-yard touchdown where he ran against Weber State. And the reason why it was one of my favorite plays was because he comes to the line of scrimmage. He sees that they're going to send a cross-dog blitz from the right. Now, the defense is going to blitz up the middle from the right side. He comes to the line. He changes the play to a quarterback run to the left, and he runs 26 yards for a touchdown. And he did that routinely throughout his career. In the starts this year, one of the things that you know, we've learned throughout the process is that he was given the play before the snap, but he was not given the protection. He set all the protections week in and week out. So he's got experience of dealing with defenses, you know, and game planning against defenses and saying, okay, you know what, in this situation with this play call, here's the protection I want, and he would set the offensive line the way that he wanted. That's something that NFL coaches are going to look at and say that's a very valuable trait to have, because not a lot of college quarterbacks are given that autonomy at the line of scrimmage, that responsibility, that authority. And with a guy that worked in a huddle and knows how to set the protections and knows how to audible and manipulate defenders, that's a really, really great trait. You saw that a lot with Carson Wentz pre-snap, but then also post-snap. You know, and I believe it was actually in that game against Weber State. They had a ton of success with post wheel. And it's actually one of my favorite plays, one of my favorite deep passing plays in football, where you have a deep post route and you got a wheel route behind it. They crushed him in the first half. It was like two or three touchdowns, two or three big plays early in the game where he was just hitting the wheel route. Wheel route was open all day. It was third quarter, safety in the middle field. They ran post wheel again. He cheats to the wheel. He goes to the post for a touchdown. And just being able to read defenses and see those types of things at that, even though, regardless of the level of competition, the safety is the safety. You know, and the windows aren't too much tighter when you get from FCS to, you know, FBS. If he was playing at Middle Tennessee State against Iowa State, you know, maybe people still would be asking questions. But, you know, Blake Bortles came out of UCF. You know, Ben Roethlisberger came out of Miami, Ohio. Joe Flacco came out of Delaware. There's always quarterbacks that come out of lower levels of competition where the windows aren't necessarily that much different.
And I think Bob McGinn, who does a great job for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel every year, he talks to scouts, relationships that he's kind of fostered throughout his years covering.
Which is always great stuff.
Exactly. And somebody said, hey, let's not forget that Carson Wentz is playing with receivers who are running 4.8s.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question.
So, I mean, he's probably the only NFL prospect on this North Dakota State offense. So
their left tackle is going to get drafted. But yeah, I'm with you. It makes sense. Yes, absolutely.
I think isolating the player, it's probably more difficult than it sounds.
It is.
But Carson Wentz does do a lot of the things that you look for. And before we move on, I just wanted to ask. You said he sets the protections. He audibles. He has a full command of the offense. Say every year you're looking at 15 quarterbacks who you think have a shot to get drafted. How common is it? What percentage of those 15 guys would you say have the command of an offense or given the command of the offense that Carson Wentz has at North Dakota State?
Well, let's see. I've watched 22 quarterbacks this year, and I'm looking at the list right now. Carson Wentz, and in terms of official authority, look, I only know about Carson Wentz that he had to call the protections. I'm just going to go off of what I could see on tape, because you can't always see how much authority they had. But Carson Wentz definitely did some things pre-snap where he was able to change some plays at the line of scrimmage. Jared Goff did not. Christian Hackenberg did his freshman year at Penn State, but did not the last 2 years. Paxton Lynch did not. Connor Cook did. Kevin Hogan did. Jake Coker did. Brandon Allen did. So you're talking four guys. Four guys in 22. So there you go. It's not common.
20 to 25% is the baseline. Sure. So just to kind of
– and it doesn't mean they can't do it, obviously.
Right. Bring this all full circle, though. People are worried about the pro readiness of Carson Wentz. Is it fair to argue that he might be more pro ready than a lot of the guys who are playing against higher level competition?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, you know, and everyone makes a big deal about the working from under center. The idea of a guy being under center as opposed to in the shotgun for all of his snaps, it's not necessarily the snap and the quarterback center exchange. It's not just that. But when you're running play action from under center, and you have to turn your back to the defense and then reset and find your receivers downfield, you're taking your eyes off of the safety rotation, the rotation of the linebackers, anything that post-snap movement within the first second, you're going to miss. And that obviously 1 second is a huge deal. That's a third of the time in terms of when you're going to have to get rid of the ball. That's a big deal. And so for quarterbacks that play in shotgun-only offenses, and you're talking about guys like Jared Goff and Paxton Lynch and Cardale Jones and some of these other guys, Jacoby Brissett was rarely under center. And if it was, a lot of these quarterbacks, when they were under center, it was a run play. So it wasn't like they had play action where they had to, again, turn their back to the defense and then turn back and survey the field. That's a big deal. And it's something, look, we've seen lots of quarterbacks come into the league and learn how to do it, but it takes time.
So one question I want to ask, because – Howie Roseman and Doug Peterson had that press conference had the press conference describing why he made this trade, why the Eagles still made this deal after re-signing Sam Bradford and bringing in Chase Daniel. It's evident to me that the Eagles want whichever quarterback they draft, whether it be Goff or Wentz, to sit for some time. And we've seen quarterbacks have great success. High draft picks, not so high draft picks, have success after sitting for a while. Most notably, Carson Palmer, Phillip Rivers. These guys have had success while learning behind a veteran. Most notably, Aaron Rodgers behind a Hall
absolutely.
Of Famer.
Yep.
But then you've had guys like Joe Flacco, Ben Roethlisberger, Cam Newton. These guys came in, played early on in their professional careers, and went on to take teams to the Super Bowl, and in the case of Flacco and Roethlisberger, win Super Bowls at some point in their career. Is there a way to answer the question, is sitting for a quarterback good? Is there a way to answer that question?
No, I mean, I think if there were a secret formula and an answer, then every team would do it, right? So to me, it's a situation-by-situation case, you know, and you look at a player like, say, a Cam Newton, where – look, his physical gifts, and we've seen some of the throws and some of the runs that guy can do. It's crazy. And Aaron Rodgers, same thing. And he had a lot of things that he had to work on mechanically and from the offense it came from, a lot of things that he had to work on. It's definitely a case-by-case basis. It's a situation where, you know, you look at David Carr. David Carr, he may have been ready, but he played behind an offensive line. He got sacked, 97 times in 2 years, whatever the number was. And he got shell-shocked, and who knows? If he goes to a different team, does he turn into a different quarterback? If you'd switched Alex Smith and Aaron Rodgers, would Aaron Rodgers be Aaron Rodgers? It's a question we don't know. We don't know the answer to that question.
Well, the Eagles are testing that philosophy with Doug Peterson as the head coach. He was the bridge quarterback to Donovan McNabb, and it's just going to be fascinating to see which of these guys they do get their hands on. At this point, I think, personally, it's going to be Carson Wentz just because that's the way it feels like the wind is blowing right now. but it could very well be Jared Goff. And now that we've broken down those deals and or the two quarterbacks who are going to be going to new places as a result of those deals, Fran, we can get into kind of what I envisioned this podcast to be. We talk about each of the four skill positions, quarterback, running back, wide receiver, tight end. We talk about the things you're looking for. If you want to sit down and with the great resources that are available to just the layperson right now who wants to get into the draft, whether it be mockdraftable.com with the spider graphs, you get to see the measurables, or draftbreakdown.com that has the wonderful cut-ups from the TV angle of basically anybody you can think of who is going to be a relatively highly regarded prospect, you can start to watch these guys. It might not be the same impact as the All-22, but you can still see some things that you're looking for. And my idea was for this, let's take a guy or two from each position that you like better than a lot of the consensus draft nicks, if you will, and a guy you like less than the consensus, just based on testing the waters, reading Twitter, reading mock drafts, and kind of describe why you like these guys a little bit better or a little bit less than some of the public does.
Sure.
And I love this because you are willing to go out there with your opinions. Fran, I don't think there is a person on earth who loves Christian Hackenberg out of Penn State as much as you do.
Well, look, here it is. I see Christian Hackenberg for what he can be. I obviously see what he was the past 2 years. And for the most part, the tape was not good on Christian Hackenberg the last 2 years. And here's the danger. And this is the thing that one of the things that I found in the process, specifically this season, I think has happened more often than not. Now that with things like Vine – and with GIFs that get spread around easily, it's very easy for a narrative to turn on a player. And so we can all see some of those worm killers from Christian Hackenberg, some of the ones that landed up in the third row on a quick bubble screen. Mm-hmm. We've seen them all. And so those latch on to people. And look, like I said, there were a lot of them. And you have to worry about the long bouts of erratic play from Christian Hackenberg. But especially with the quarterback position, from the TV angle, it's tough to see a lot of different things. And I'm not saying that that's the case necessarily with Christian Hackenberg, but it's just you have to be able to see some of the other traits that come through. And a lot of the times watching Christian Hackenberg, I've been able to see him throw with great anticipation, not just as a freshman, not just in spurts, even just last year, going back to his sophomore year against Boston College in the bowl game. I can remember some of the throws he made along the sideline to some of his receivers in that game were just remarkable. There was a touch pass he threw against Michigan down the seam late in the game, dropped by Kyle Carter. I mean, just perfectly placed. He read that it was a split safety look. He had his tight end going down the seam. He had a linebacker with his back turned to him. He dropped the ball right into the tight end's lap, and he dropped it. Same thing, Ohio State, late first quarter, and this past season, faced edge pressure. He stepped up against the pressure, delivered a beautiful touch pass on a deep crossing route from the opposite hash outside the numbers. I mean, the pass was 30, 35 yards out, dropped. Yeah, and so there are situations like that. And the sacks, I was there for the Temple game. I feel like he got sacked 97 times in that game. And that was week one, and he looked shell-shocked. And that was a little bit of a concern. And I think that's a concern because sometimes he does not handle pressure the way he should. But I see the flashes. And so now, honestly, my big concern is, after what he's dealt with the last 2 years, is he shell-shocked moving forward? Is he broken? If he's not broken, and I haven't seen anything or heard anything over the last 5 months to make me think that he is, I think that he's definitely worth an earlier round pick than what people insinuate.
And there's many who don't think he should be drafted at all.
Yes.
And I mean, that is. And you acknowledge the tape is bad on him, but man, there's going to be excuses made for Christian Hackenberg, and I think
Absolutely. People
are going to kind of roll their eyes at the excuses because, once again, you can get back to some of the games. And I think more so than – and I think this is true of basically any prospect, especially at the quarterback position, Fran, but I think it's more true with Hackenberg than just about anybody I have seen in my time in professional football. If you take his best 50 plays or even his best game, I think I would argue that his game against Boston College in the bowl game his sophomore year – was the best game he ever played in his college career.
Yeah.
You want to talk an NFL game. You take that game, you're convinced this guy's an all-time type of prospect.
Yeah, and even like you can go to some of the – and I watched him against some of the teams that had some legitimate NFL prospects on defense. You think Michigan State, Ohio State, Illinois. There was a play – and pocket movement is a great example, okay? And that's one of the traits. Obviously, the NFL game is won from the pocket, from the quarterback position. And pocket movement is a big part of that, obviously. Being able to handle pressure, be able to deal with bodies around you, and be able to execute, step up, and throw. There was a play early against Illinois, and he loses his right guard and his center in protection. Both guys just get beat immediately. The pocket closes in on him. He keeps his eyes downfield. He steps up, and he delivers a frozen rope on a wheel route for a big play. You know, and I saw so much of that throughout his career. There was another play against Michigan. And, again, he had a lot of big plays against some of these teams that had legitimate NFL defenses. He feels pressure from the outside. He steps up in the pocket. He puts the ball perfectly into the hands of a wide receiver deep in the end zone, goes right through his hands. Again, showing a feel for working in the pocket. Were there examples of plays where he didn't? Absolutely, there were plays where he didn't. And that's what I was saying earlier is that you can find plays where he didn't. You can find plays where he threw the ball 3 yards into the stands, or you can find plays where he threw it 8 yards before his receiver. Absolutely. And maybe I'm on the other side, and I'm just trying to find the bright spots.
Right.
But I, to me, if I'm looking at quarterback prospects, what a guy can be moving forward, if you feel comfortable that the kid is okay and not broken, there are some physical traits there that are top level in terms of NFL prospect.
Just to be devil's advocate here. And this is a question I raised a couple years ago when Logan Thomas was coming out of Virginia Tech. You want to talk about a traits prospect?
Sure.
Logan Thomas was a traits prospect. How often, though, do we see a guy who, let's be frank, wasn't good in college become a good NFL quarterback?
That's a very fair question. That's a very fair question.
And I think we see it at other positions. I just have not seen it at the quarterback position. And Christian Hackenberg, the talent is here. And I mean, I think it's easy to feel bad for the kid, frankly. He didn't need to stay at Penn State. He didn't need to keep his commitment. And then once Bill O'Brien left, he didn't need to stay. But he stayed, played in an offense that didn't fit him. And his own star kind of dimmed. And that'll lead us to the guy who you like probably less than the consensus. Another traits prospect whose production level was not there. But he has a national championship, and it's Cardale Jones of Ohio State. And this is a question that a lot of people probably are going to have after hearing you talk about Carson Wentz. You try to isolate the traits of the player. Why is Carson Wentz, in terms of physical traits, somebody you love, while Cardale Jones, in terms of physical traits, is somebody you don't?
Well, mainly because, yeah, the arm is there with Cardale Jones and the athletic ability is there with Cardale Jones, but the quarterback traits are not there with Cardale Jones. And, you know, and so, yeah, when I watched him during that three-game stretch in 2014, I was impressed, number one, with his decision-making. You know, and one of the things I wrote down was that I thought that he did a really good job of knowing when to play for the next down, not forcing anything if it was first down and not forcing throws into coverage, you know, throwing it out into the out of bounds or throwing it through the back of the end zone in the red zone. I thought that he did a good job with plays like that. But look, that job was his for the taking coming back this past year. And I was really hoping that he was going to take it by the reins because, look, JT Barrett's a nice player, and I've studied JT Barrett, and I'm going to study him more, obviously, going into next year. But he's more physically gifted than JT Barrett. I was really hoping that he was going to take that job by the reins. But you know, you're watching a player work mostly in the shotgun, so he's going to have to all the things we talked about earlier about working from under center. He's got to improve his footwork. His lower body mechanics were all over the place. He'll square up to his target early, and this is something that Christian Hackenberg does as well. Square up to his target, and his feet. His lower body mechanics, his throwing platform are often thrown off, and that affects his accuracy, both stationary and on the move. The biggest thing with me is he does not have a feel for playing in the pocket. You know, he's going to drop his eyes under pressure at times. He'll run whenever he's given the chance to. That's not something that translates well to the NFL. He commits that cardinal sin of exiting through the back of the pocket. He's very slow to process things post-snap. From what I saw this past season, that was something that worried me. Was I thought that he left a lot of plays on the field. He was not an anticipation thrower in an offense that lend yourself to have wide windows. He didn't always take advantage of those wide windows because it's a speed offense. It's a misdirection offense. A big part of that is the run game. He didn't always take advantage of that. And so a guy that there are some questions. You know, we've seen Urban Meyer has come out and said that teams are going to need patience with him. From a pure physical ability, from a physical traits perspective, He's got a lot going for him. But from a quarterback traits perspective, I just don't see it with Cardale Jones. He's going to need a lot more work. And honestly, I'm looking at other prospects that in this draft, because it's a good quarterback draft. I'm going to go in another direction before I go to Cardale Jones.
7 interceptions in college. Now, he only started 11 games, but you look at the numbers and you're like, heck, he only threw 7 interceptions. And that brings up the decision-making on your part. But it was the plays he didn't make that got him benched towards the end of the season.
The guy was 11-0 as a starter.
He didn't lose a game. And, I mean, like, it's so hard to make the case for benching this guy if you look just at the numbers. But right. Urban Meyer, I think, is a coach who understands, I'm calling my offense to make it easy for quarterbacks. And when they're not making the plays that I have designed for them to make, it's frustrating for him. And Cardale Jones, I'm looking at a guy who, I think he made the wrong decision. I think he should have come out last year, and he probably would have been a higher pick. And maybe he bailed the team out by going back to school.
Maybe. And obviously we'll never know the answer to that. Again, he's got 11 starts under his belt. No quarterback drafted in the last 5 years has that few. I think the lowest actually was 12. And if he only came out with 3 last year, man, that would have been a very interesting case study. I still can't imagine that he would have been more than it. I mean, Brett Hundley went in the 6th round. Would he have gotten drafted ahead of Brett Hundley? I don't know. I personally, I would have taken Hundley ahead of him. But
another one of those unanswerable
questions. No doubt.
Let's slide to the running back position. Sure. And this is one of my favorite positions to watch every year, because even though the NFL has started to become specialized and we get people complaining about it every year for fantasy because teams seem to love having 3 backs to roll with, I just think there is such a great talent level at this position in college. And there's so many fun players to watch in these offenses. But from the TV angle, Fran, I always bring this up with you when I'm talking to you. It's so hard for me to get a read on vision when I'm watching from the TV angle, because it is hard to see where the lanes open up. And are there any suggestions you can make to somebody who's maybe watching on draftbreakdown.com or just watching a game on a Saturday night where they're like, oh, you know, I'm going to check out that Alabama running back. I've heard a lot of good things about him. Or I'm going to check out the Louisiana Tech running back because I've heard a lot of good things about him. What are some of the things just the common layperson can look for if they want to break down the running back position?
Well, you mentioned vision, and that is certainly the lifeline for running backs in the NFL. You need to have good vision and instincts if you're going to succeed. Explosiveness is great, and athletic ability is great, but one speed guys, they can be effective in the NFL. We've seen that in the past. We've seen guys like Alfred Morris, who was never a dynamic athlete for sure, mm-hmm. coming out of FAU, was never that kind of guy coming out of college, had a very solid career during his time with Washington. And, so we've seen guys like that happen. But the big thing with Alfred Morris was he was very decisive downhill. He was a great zone runner. So you have to have an understanding of the run schemes. And, again, that's something that I've really tried to hone my recognition on is, as I'm watching offenses now, what kind of run team are they? Because, you're looking for slightly different traits. Ultimately, you still need a lot of the same things, but you're looking for slightly different traits from, a team that runs mostly inside-outside zone, or if you're a power counter team. If you're a gap scheme team, you might value acceleration and burst a little bit more than decisiveness, because you're declaring for the back, here's the gap we need you to hit. And if it's not this gap, it's this gap. And you're only asking to make one read, whereas on an outside zone play, a running back might have four passes of departure. He might have 4 different gaps that he can hit, and he's reading his blocks in front of him and deciding, reading the flow of the defense of the front 7, where am I going? So you need a guy that's decisive, that's instinctive, understands the run scheme versus zone scheme, whereas you can get away with a little bit more if you're a gap scheme team.
Now, that being said, there's a lot of backs in this class and in the NFL who probably can fit both schemes to a varying level of
Definitely.
Success.
And it's usually the case.
And teams mix up this. Very rarely, I would say, Fran, does a team run exclusively one or
it's
the other.
It's not the case. Yes, exactly right.
Like the Dallas Cowboys, I think people view them primarily as a zone team, but they run a lot of gap concepts.
Yeah, you're going to see and Chip Kelly was an inside-outside zone team. Yeah. But every once in a while, you saw power. And it was their number 3 run outside of inside zone. You ran power. And also, too, let's say if you're a zone team and you think that Kenyon Drake is a good example. Kenyon Drake's not going to be a feature back in the NFL regardless, but let's just say that he was a little bit bigger and you thought he could be a feature gap in a gap scheme team because his vision's not great. But if you're a zone team and you need a third down change of pace type guy, a guy that you can move around the formation and try and create matchups with as a, you know, 10, 15 snap a game type of player, you may take Kenyon Drake. Even though he's not an outstanding fit as a you know, in a primarily zone scheme, you may take a guy like Kenyon Drake because of what he can do elsewhere. So it's really a case-by-case basis, and you're trying to find the fit and how he's going to be used. His utilization in the NFL is going to mean a lot to the team that drafts him.
For fantasy purposes, I think it's fair to say that this year's running back class is not as deep as last year's, which was one of my all-time favorites.
It's not going to be like next year's.
And next year's is mind-blowing. Yeah. We're talking guys, you might have three or four guys who are going to be in the first-round conversation.
Potentially, yep.
This is still not a bad class, though, Fran, and I think there's some under-the-radar backs who I think could be really good at the next level, and there are two that you highlighted to me as guys you think are better than maybe the general public thinks they are. And number one is a guy who didn't even play this year.
Yep.
And that's Jonathan Williams out of Arkansas.
Yeah.
And the more you watch him, if you go back and watch his 2014 tape, this is a guy who probably would be a second-round pick if he wasn't hurt.
If he wasn't hurt, absolutely.
And he might be anyway, even though he was hurt, because of the traits that he has.
Yeah, and he was one of my – coming into the season – Kenneth Dixon and Jonathan Williams were neck and neck for me at the running back group in the senior
Everybody's
class.
Everybody's on Dixon now.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And I've loved Dixon since the first time I watched him. And Williams as well. Like I said, they were very close to me. Williams hurt his foot. He had a broken bone in his foot. And that's, for a running back, that's a very tough thing to try and get a hold of. We've seen running backs, you think back to Chris Polk, that have those kinds of injuries coming out of school, and it lingers. And so that's going to be the question every team's going to have to answer with Jonathan Williams. I would expect that that's going to affect his draft slot. But you're talking about a player who's 5'11", 220 pounds. He's got good size, great play personality. I mean, this guy is super competitive. He's a lot quicker than you would think for a 220-pound back. Really, really good at making defenders miss. He makes the first man miss so well. He's got good wiggle. He's got good contact balance. Can play inside, can play outside, catches the ball well, can block. I mean, this guy is very, very well-rounded. The biggest knock on him is that he's not an otherworldly athlete. His burst is solid, but it's nothing that you're going to write home about and say, oh, my God, I need to get, you know, it's not Melvin Gordon, but he's a much better runner than Melvin Gordon. So, the traits are there for Jonathan Williams if he can stay healthy. And every team's going to have to decide that for themselves. The traits are there for him to be a feature back in the NFL, in my opinion.
Worth pointing out, big ball security problems in college, and you do need to clean those up, or you're not going to get on the field on a consistent basis. I was an Amir Abdullah lover last year, but his ball security problems in college unfortunately showed up in the NFL. Hopefully Jonathan Williams, as he's getting healthier, can clean up those issues, but this is a guy who's built like a three-down back and plays like one.
Yeah, no question.
For fantasy, those guys are becoming rare. It's worth noting when those guys have the potential to become that. So Jonathan Williams might not be a name for your dynasty drafts who is going to be going among the top 6, 7, 8 picks, but should certainly be someone, depending on his landing spot, you should be considering for the future, because this is a talented guy. And another productive guy who is smaller than Jonathan Williams, but I think plays really tough, is Paul Perkins,
yep,
out of UCLA. And I see some Frank Gore in Paul Perkins. In
that
he doesn't have breakaway speed.
Sure, definitely not.
But, man, he is capable of getting into the open field from spots where 95% of the running backs in this class are not getting out of.
And a lot of people have seen that long run against Stanford, where I think he made six defenders miss on that
yes.
play. It was just something silly. He made three miss before he got to the line of scrimmage. His ability to make defenders miss is his number one trait. And I was down. I was very late on Paul Perkins because I watched him as a sophomore. And you mentioned it, the breakaway speed, more the short area burst is just not there. And I think that's a very questionable trait for him moving forward, is that he does not have a great burst in a short area. But he's got lightning in his feet, man, in terms of being able to move laterally and make defenders miss. And that's something you're always looking for at the next level. Some people have made the comparison to a Devontae Freeman, which I think is valid too. I think there's a little bit of that there with Paul Perkins, another guy who can play all three downs because he can block as well as any back in this draft. Certainly one of the better third down options because of that. He's put on weight. You know, he put on 12 pounds coming in from 2014 to 2015, added a little bit more coming into the combine, was the one of the leading rushers in the Pac-12 this year, a reliable catcher out of the backfield, but the vision and the ability to make defenders miss is what stands out for Paul Perkins.
You want to check out this run against Stanford if you haven't seen it. If you go to fantasyguru.com and you go to our pre-draft rookie report, I have it linked.
Yeah.
But if you just search Paul Perkins Stanford on YouTube, it's going to be the first result, I guarantee.
And let me say this, is that, and I mentioned this earlier about how the vines and everyone thinks of one play. Yeah. A lot of people said last year that Melvin Gordon had great vision because of this one long run that he had against LSU where he read the block in front of him, he took off into the open field, you saw that great speed, and he was off and running, and it was a touchdown. That, and you didn't really see that for most of the rest of when you watched Melvin Gordon. Paul Perkins, you see those missed tackles very often. He's one of the best, and I didn't chart it this year, but he is one of the best in this class from my memory in terms of forced missed tackles in a running back.
One thing you've been mentioning a lot is light feet, quick feet. What does that mean? When you're watching a guy, is this something you can see on TV? If a guy has light feet, and the opposite, obviously, yeah, being heavy feet.
I think so. And Greg Cosell just actually threw out a term to me. He and I filmed a film room series on PhiladelphiaEagles.com a few weeks back, and it's been running every other day here on PhiladelphiaEagles.com. Spontaneous agility was the term he used, and
he comes up with some great ones.
I love that. And really what you're talking about is that ability. I talked with Kenyon Barner about this. It was an Eagles backup Eagles running back. Talked to him about it in the fall and in terms of vision for a back and how important that is. And he said that one of the things they did at Oregon was the coach would turn the lights off in a room and he would take a laser pointer out and point it in different directions. And the backs would all have to use their eyes and follow the laser around the room just as a way to really train them to follow movement and instantly react. That reaction quickness is really what you're looking for. So, you know, a defender shows up in your gap, your ability to jump cut, find another gap, and get downhill quickly and make defenders miss. You see a lot of players in this class that have that, as Cosell likes to put it, that spontaneous agility, and some don't. You know, guys like Derrick Henry don't necessarily have that.
Let's talk about Derrick Henry.
Sure.
Because I first realized your opinion on Derrick Henry when I texted you. I think it was sometime in October. And Derrick Henry was probably dropping 370 yards on some poor SEC team. And I texted you and I think I said, man, the more I watch Henry, the less I like him. And this is a controversial opinion. Now, I think people are starting to understand this, but I just don't see the explosive traits like you would see in a guy like Ezekiel Elliott or in Kenneth Dixon when it comes to Derrick Henry. And let's be completely honest. Derrick Henry is massive. He's 6'3". He's nearly 250 pounds. Big men should not have the speed that Derrick Henry has.
Have you seen the picture of him next to Eddie Lacy from this offseason?
Eddie Lacy. Now, Eddie Lacy has lost weight this offseason.
Right.
He made that but Eddie Lacy looks like me or you next to Derrick Henry.
Yeah, Eddie Lacy. He looks like someone put this perfectly on Twitter. He looks like a Marvel superhero standing next to Eddie Lacy. The kid's freakishly big for a running back.
And I think there is a specific fit for Derrick Henry. However, this is going to sound blasphemous, just like it sounded blasphemous when at fantasyguru.com we ranked Melvin Gordon, I think, lowest of any major fantasy site last year.
And rightfully so. I was glad you guys did it.
Because you look at the production. You look at the production against the level of competition, but I think there are limited traits. I think there are limited areas where Derrick Henry succeeds, and I know you agree. What do you see in Derrick Henry that scares you? But on the flip side, what do you see that you like, and what kind of situation would he succeed in the National Football League?
Obviously, look, he's got great size. He's really, really big for the running back position. And I think he's strong. I think he could be tough to bring down. He's excellent in pass protection, and he's got better at that throughout his career. That was a question for me coming into the season, and he got better at that, so it's a way for him to stay on the field. Ball security was pretty good. He only had one or two fumbles. I've watched 16 games of Derrick Henry for the last 2 years. Because I've won every time I finish watching him, and I go a few more weeks, I'm like, I'm going to go back and watch another game or two. Mm-hmm. Because I just want to make sure that I'm right with this, because you want to like him. The physicality, you know, the speed in the open field, you mentioned that. I mean, guys that big should not run that fast in a straight line, and he's able to do that. He can pull away in the open field. I just don't know that Derrick Henry is a feature back in the NFL in the way that an Adrian Peterson, a Marshawn Lynch, some of these other bigger backs have been featured ball carriers for an offense in the NFL. You know, I'm not sold on his instincts yet as a runner. He's not a great athlete laterally for the position. His burst is solid, but his change of direction, his flexibility, that was reflected in his combine numbers for the three cone and the short shuttle. I just have a lot of questions at this stage about his ability to make defenders miss in a short area. That spontaneous agility there is a question for me. And for a guy that's that big, who's going to take a lot of hits, and Lance Zierlein from NFL.com put it out there, it was a really interesting number. His 395 carries are more than any NFL running back over the last 15 years, other than Larry Johnson's in 2006, where he had 416. So a huge workload, not necessarily over his college career, but coming into over last season, it's a concern. But he can go somewhere if a team says, you know what, if you're Dallas, and in that scheme with what Dallas is doing up front, as a tracker, the way that they used DeMarco Murray in 2014, and you know we've heard all the terms with DeMarco Murray, you know, a track runner, needs things up front. If Derrick Henry has an offensive line where they're creating for him and they're opening up, much like what he had for the most part at Alabama, where they're doing work for him and he's got a hole and he's able to hit that hole, he's going to be in good shape.
And there are traits here to be a perennial 1,000-yard, 10-touchdown type of runner in that kind of offense. But
if he can hold up physically, and which is a question.
Let me be honest here. I don't think he ran with the power.
No,
that you
and that's
want
fair too.
A guy his size to run with. And I'm talking in short yardage.
I wrote down he did not break as many tackles as you would think for a back his size, and he went down on first contact more than I'd like to see considering his physical skill set. That's something I have written in my notes.
I think he could be a successful back, certainly Dallas. And we always say that about maybe guys you view as limited. Oh, if Melvin Gordon went to Dallas last year, he was running for 1,300 yards. Or if Tevin Coleman went to Dallas, he was running for 1,300 yards. This year, maybe you might say, if Jordan Howard goes to Dallas, right, he's got a shot to run for 1,000 yards. And I think certainly Derrick Henry's going to have that opportunity if he goes to Dallas. But maybe he projects better as a LeGarrette Blount replacement, say, in an offense like the Patriots.
And he might. And that's actually, it's funny. We've talked about both guys. Now that you brought up Blount, the two guys that I have in my comparison are LeGarrette Blount and Melvin Gordon.
He's a bigger Melvin Gordon. I think he's probably a better LeGarrette Blount. We've seen Brandon Jacobs because of the size. Personally, I think Brandon Jacobs is a more agile runner than Derrick Henry. I think he has lighter feet.
Yeah, and that's, it's going to be, I'm really interested to watch Derrick Henry as he transitions to the NFL and see the situation he ends up in. Just see how he does. And keep in mind, remember the issues that Trent Richardson had once he got to the league in terms of being able to make defenders miss and going down on first contact. He's bigger. Derrick Henry is bigger and less athletic. It'll be interesting to watch.
For fantasy, I view Henry as a guy who's going to be touchdown dependent. And we hate those guys, fantasy.
Right.
If you get them the right week and they score three touchdowns like LeGarrette Blount has been wont to do, wonderful. He's going to drive you nuts the rest of the time, like a guy like Alfred Morris. And
I do think that if he gets drafted by Dallas, he's going to have to be a first-round dynasty pick. He's going to have to be.
Has to be. Has certainly.
To be. You
and
have to.
This is why we re-rank these guys after they're drafted.
No,
because
question.
You have to evaluate the situation. One other guy, Fran, that you're not as high on, he's a bigger name for those who follow the draft. And he's a different player than Derrick Henry. He's much more productive as a receiver. But left, you're wanting more in other areas, was Devontae Booker,
yes,
of Utah. And there are some major red flags with Devontae Booker.
Big red flags. You mentioned his receiving ability, and that's probably his best trait, is his abilities as a receiver. Yeah, and he catches the ball really well. They moved him all around the formation. But he's not a player that does the little things well as a running back. Many of his strengths, his ball skills, his contact balance are natural innate traits that he rolls out of bed with, and he's able to catch the ball and he's able to break a tackle here and there. But he struggles in areas where work is needed to improve. His ball security is awful. Some of the best. I've watched 12 games of Devontae Booker. He's put the ball on the ground 7 times in 12 games. He needs to improve there. His blocking needs a lot of work. Holding on to the ball in the right hand, and that's a factor of ball security, not just ball security, but then also being able to ward defenders off. If you're running down the left sideline, and if you close your eyes and you picture this, a running back is running down the left sideline, and he's got the ball in his right hand. If a defender is coming from the field, you have nothing. You can't use your arm as a weapon. You can't do anything to shield him off because you have the ball in your right hand. Your left hand is running free down the sideline. And those things didn't just happen on the sideline. It also happened, in traffic. Where if he's run to the left, he's got the ball in his right hand, and a linebacker comes downhill, he's got no way to break that tackle. And so a lot of little things with Devontae Booker. His vision, I didn't think, was very good. The ball security, the athleticism, I didn't think was great. We haven't seen him work out yet just because of the injury that he suffered. He had an injury late in the season that kept him from going to the Senior Bowl, kept him from working out at the combine. But athletically, I think he's limited. A lot of people thought that he was the number one running back in the senior class, had him ranked ahead of Kenneth Dixon and Jonathan Williams and Kenyon Drake and some of these other guys. I just never saw it with Booker.
He looks like he transitions. You watch him. He looks like he transitions best as a third down back. The problem is terrible ball security, and he wasn't a particularly good blocker. So these are two things that you need to work on if you're going to be playing in these incredibly important situations, and coaches are going to bench you otherwise. So Devontae Booker, I think some fair questions about his ability to transition to the NFL. Let's move on to the wide receiver position, because yeah, I know you got some incredibly strong takes here that people are really going to be interested to hear. But it's a fun position to watch. Probably a lot harder to watch from the TV angle, in my opinion, than the running back position.
I would agree with that.
You can't see really the entire subtlety of a guy's route running.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's my biggest nitpick, I think, with the process in terms of evaluating receivers and their route running abilities, because we're going to get into this. My favorite receiver in this class is Tyler Boyd. And a lot of people will count him as a great route runner. And they see it because, again, we get the vines of the TV replays and the GIFs of the TV replays of him winning on a double move for a touchdown on a post corner or on a sluggo route. And we see that with a lot of receivers in this draft. The way I look at a guy winning on a double move, that's why coaches call these plays with double moves, is because you're going to win. So for a receiver to run a double move and win, he's doing what he's supposed to do. For me to call him a good route runner because of that is saying that my mom is a good driver because she stops at every red light. Supposed to stop at every red light, but there are lots of other things. She cuts the drivers off left and right when we're driving down I-95. She's an awful driver. But because she stops at every red light, and you see that, you might say, oh, yeah, she's a great route runner, or she's a great driver. That's the same way I look at route running in terms of, yeah, that's great that a guy can separate in a double move. You can see the burst. You see the ability to sink his hips and drive out. That's great. But I want to see if a guy can separate on a deep comeback. I want to see if he can separate on a regular post. I want to see if he can separate on a dig. How does he do with the drive phase of the route? In the drive phase, imagine a receiver running downfield, and he breaks down. He changes his stride length. He pats his feet down. He crouches a little bit. And now at this point, is he going to run a stutter go? Is he going to run a post? Is he going to run a corner? Is he going to run a dig? Is it going to be a comeback? Is it going to be a curl? The guys that are able to do that, hide your intentions, and then also mess with defenders mid-route. Are they working the red line while downfield? And that's a matter of ball skills as well. But, guys that show the ability to do that, That's a great route runner in the college level.
When you're describing that, the ability of a guy to break down and then sell different routes, I think of Odell Beckham.
Absolutely, I think
Odell Beckham's
no
phenomenal
question.
In that area.
Him and Jarvis Landry were so good at that when they were together at LSU. I mean, so good at that at LSU.
We've seen Odell Beckham just absolutely school Richard Sherman. And once again, you're talking about the vine culture. When the Giants took on the Seahawks, I believe this was in Odell Beckham's rookie season, there was a vine that went around of him just absolutely torching Richard Sherman on a double move, but it showed the ability of Odell Beckham to break down and fool even one of the best corners in the NFL. And these are the traits you're kind of looking for. And that's why I want to get to Tyler Boyd out of Pitt, because you were super high on Christian Hackenberg. Well, Christian Hackenberg is not your number one quarterback in this class.
Yes.
Tyler Boyd is your number one wide receiver. And those who love measurables, like maybe the spider graphs over at mockdraftable.com, are going to call you absolutely insane for this. You need a microscope to see Tyler Boyd's spider graph. I mean, he did not test well at the combine. You would admit this.
Yes.
So what is it about Tyler Boyd? Why is he – what makes him better than guys who tested both well and had production and had the tape?
Well, and here's my thing is that it's not – when I say number one, I don't rank players in that way in terms of, oh, I think this guy's going to be so much better than Josh Doctson, right? I just rank it in terms of the traits that I look at. How do I feel about this guy transitioning to the NFL? And there's obviously the whole player versus prospect debate, and that's all valid, and that's why – you know, I don't put – people ask me all the time on Twitter, oh, do you put a big board out? Do you put rank it? No, because I honestly don't think rankings mean anything. That's why you redo rankings for fantasy, right? Because
– after they're drafted, we blow up the entire pre-draft rookie report.
Right, and there's a reason for that, because how the guy is used in the NFL has a huge impact on how he's going to progress, you know? So I'm going to watch Tyler Boyd, and I'm really anxious to watch him progress. But what do I see when I watch him? I mean, he's 6'1.5". He's 197 pounds. He's got outstanding ball skills. Him and Josh Doctson in this class have outstanding ball skills. They play the ball so well in the air. They're super competitive. They've got great ball, not just the ball skills, but also the hands to finish at the catch point. You see the deceptive route running. He does need to clean some things up, and no question about it, but you see the potential to be a very good route runner. Is he a blazer? No, absolutely not. But I think he plays fast enough that he can still be a competitive deep threat, especially because he's got the ability to go up and win the deep ball as well as any running back or as any receiver in this draft class. Saw it so many times throughout his career. He was used in a way this year where, you know, a lot, because that's the thing, is a lot of people look at him and say, oh, well, how could he be a good deep ball guy? He averaged 13 yards a catch this year. Well, let me tell you something. They lost their running back, James Conner. They moved him all over the formation this year, ran all kinds of fly sweeps with him, ran him out of the wildcat, and he was running in the slot, out wide, X, Z, anywhere he needed to line up, he lined up. Running those fly sweeps where he's running in front of the quarterback tosses him the ball, and he goes for 6 yards, that counts as a pass in college football. So that's going to bring those yards per catch numbers down. That's not how he's going to be used at the NFL level.
And that's still a play that the coaches are going to consider a win. You get 6 yards on that type of play. That's a win.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I look at Tyler Boyd. I see the ball skills. I see the competitiveness. I see the ability to be a great route runner. I see the play speed. Needs to be a little bit more consistent as a route runner, but I think that he can get better there. I really, really like what that kid brings to the table.
How does he compare to a guy you just mentioned, Jarvis Landry? For those who are looking for maybe a fantasy comparison.
Sure. I think that Landry, it's a good question. I never thought about that before. I think it's pretty comparable, and especially if you remember the spider graph for Jarvis Landry.
Similar.
Yeah, I mean, it was worse. Landry's spider graph would have been a lot worse. His combine was historically bad. Boyd went, he ran 4.5. I think Landry ran 4.7-ish. And there's always examples of that. And again, the numbers can always tell whatever story you want them to tell. But just for me, watching Tyler Boyd, I think that he translates well to the NFL.
Another guy you like where maybe the downside isn't necessarily in his athleticism as it is in off-field things is DeMarcus Robinson out of Florida.
Yeah.
This is a guy you like. I haven't really heard his name much, maybe in the Twitter sphere, on draft Twitter. Not a ton of people talking about him as much as some of the guys who are getting recently hyped, like Sterling Shepard, like maybe a Leonte Carew. Not as many people talking about DeMarcus Robinson. But if he is capable of cleaning up his act, what kind of player can he be in the NFL?
And cleaning up his act, he was suspended, I think it was reported, 4 times in 3 years at Florida, all different kinds of issues. Who knows exactly what the deal is, but obviously that may play a part into where he's drafted. But this kid's smooth, man. I know his 40 time wasn't outstanding. I think he ran mid 4.5s at the combine, but he is a smooth athlete. He catches the ball really well. He can run whatever route you need him to, and he did it at a pretty high level. He was a good route runner at the college level. He's not really a contested catch guy, but he wins more in the small game in terms of the receiver position. He can win downfield. He can win in the screen game, a lot of drive routes, yards after catch. He's good in those types of situations. And the fact that he can get after it as a blocker as well. You saw him do that throughout his career at Florida, get after it in the run game as a blocker. His uncle Marcus played receiver in the NFL, was a bit of a tutor for him the last couple of years during
fantasy
his time at Florida. Marcus Robinson, sure. So DeMarcus Robinson is a guy that I think a team's going to get this guy, you know, whether it's, you know, late round three or, you know, sometime on day three, they're going to get a quality player as long as he can, you know, keep things right off the field.
And it was three marijuana violations and a missed curfew. Now, he was suspended under both Will Muschamp and Jim McElwain, so under two different coaches did he have these problems. But, you know, honestly, in my generation, I don't really look at marijuana violations as something that I personally worry about. Unfortunately, Fran, it is against the rules in the National Football League.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, every team's got to decide how they feel about that.
And I do view him as a guy who could become an interesting player, certainly somebody to watch who maybe a team has an extra fourth or maybe an extra fifth round pick if he slips a little bit.
Where
take
you can get
gamble.
You can get a second round talent. You
know, on the guy.
That guy's talented. Yeah.
And I think interviews were probably a big thing for DeMarcus Robinson, but the tapes certainly shows up. Now let's get to some guys maybe you like a little bit less than the consensus. And I view this one as interesting, Fran, because when Laquon Treadwell was putting up subpar numbers at his pro day, and he wasn't testing well athletically, I think people started to trash him a little bit. And then people realized, hey, if I turn on the tape and I watch this guy play, he can really play football. So I think he's kind of gone through the ebbs and the flows of the pre-draft season, where it seemed like people were down on him. Now they're high on him again. But you're a little bit lower. You don't think he's the best receiver in this class.
Know what it is? I think that he can be a dominant player at times in the National Football League. He's got the ability to take over a game because of his ability in those contested catch situations. He's got really long arms. He's not his game is not built on his straight line speed. His game is built on the big man's game. That's winning those contested throws, those back shoulder throws. I just have never seen Laquon Treadwell as a, you know, top 10 type receiver. You know, and that's just me. You know, and I didn't see him as Mike Evans. I didn't see him as, you know, Odell Beckham, some of the bigger receivers or the guys that win in those areas. I didn't see him as that kind of player. I always saw him kind of as like an Alshon Jeffrey. And he went similar spot in the draft where I think he should go. I think that Alshon should be more of a late first at best receiver in terms of his draft slot. And honestly, I think that he might be better off as that, you know, solid number one, but you probably still need some other pieces to go along with him in your receiving corps because he can do a lot of different things. He's better after the catch than given credit for. They used him a lot in the screen game. He's got good vision with the ball in his hands. I don't think Treadwell's a bad player, and he's a great blocker. He gets after it in the run game. The big thing with me with Treadwell was I watched him as a sophomore. I think he was 230 pounds. I watched him run, and this guy looks like he's going to be a tight end. I was really worried coming into the season. Like, I don't think this guy's an NFL receiver in terms of his athleticism. Luckily, he got down to 212 coming into this year. He broke his leg late in the season as a sophomore, got down to 212, and he looked a little bit better athletically this past season. So I felt a little bit better. He's at a good weight now. He's at 221 at the combine, and he's still moving okay. I like Treadwell. I'm just not as high on him as, you know, some people think that he could go like number 10 to the New York Giants. I don't see him that way.
Now, that being said, you compared him to Alshon Jeffrey. Alshon was a second round draft pick, but you redraft the draft where Alshon Jeffrey came out. That guy's going in the first round. And if you were to tell a team you're going to draft Laquon Treadwell and he's going to be Alshon Jeffrey, doesn't that make him a first round pick?
To me, it just depends on what else you've got in your. It's like I said, I don't. If Laquon Treadwell is your main weapon, I don't know if your offense is going to be, you know, a high. And again, it's a situation by situation case. I just don't look at Laquon Treadwell as a Dez Bryant, AJ Green, that type of level of dominant receiver, you know, quote unquote number one type player. I don't, you know, and that role means a lot of different things. I don't see him as that kind of receiver. I don't see him as that level of guy. And I'm not taking a receiver in the top 10 unless I think he's that kind of talent.
Another guy who I would agree with you is not a number one type of receiver by any stretch and maybe is more of a piece to a passing game, who has gotten some first round hype, but I don't really like him in that area is Will Fuller of Notre Dame. And I think saying he's limited is maybe selling him a little short, because he can absolutely fly. I mean, there is an elite trait there with Will Fuller. It's the other areas where he struggles. And I think it was Mackenzie Alexander of Clemson who was asked about Will Fuller. And he was asked about what was it like playing him. He's like, he's fast, but what else does he do? And I think Mackenzie Alexander held him to two catches. And there's concerns about Will Fuller's ability to transition as well then.
Yeah, you know, Fuller can be a really good piece for an offense. And again, it comes down to, you know, what does that mean? For some teams, that means a lot. For some teams, if you need a number one receiver, you're not looking at Will Fuller to be that guy. Guy ran 4.28. He's super explosive, and that shows up on tape. You see that in the screen game and yards after catch, and you see that on vertical routes. Here are the two big questions. Ball skills are not great. Not just the hands, but also playing the deep ball down the air. And we saw that with a guy like Sammy Coates a year ago. He fell down to the third round. Yeah. Playing the ball in the air was an issue at times. The other issue, too, and it's funny, a lot of people crushed Devin Smith last year. And you remember, I liked Devin Smith out of Ohio State. He was a second-round pick from the New York Jets, got hurt early, and it was kind of out of commission there. But I think Fuller is worse in some of these areas than Devin Smith was. First of all, Devin Smith was great at playing the ball in the air. But laterally, I have some questions about Devin or about Will Fuller. The ability to run routes over the middle of the field, that lateral agility, below average numbers showed up at the combine, and I was not surprised to see that in terms of his short shuttle. His short shuttle was 4.27. His three cone was 6.93. Both were below average for the receiver position in terms of guys that were drafted the last 5 years. I wasn't shocked to see that because I thought there was a little bit of lateral stiffness to him watching him. But the guy can fly, and he can bring that vertical element to an offense.
This is a major concern for me. If I'm drafting Will Fuller, not playing the deep ball well, there might be other receivers in this class. Maybe Laquon Treadwell or your guy Tyler Boyd doesn't play the deep ball well. But that's not nearly as big an issue for them as it would be for Will Fuller.
Well, Boyd actually plays the deep ball really, really well. That's the big thing. But I see what you mean. I see what you mean.
Right.
I see what you mean.
You're a type of receiver like that.
No doubt. Exactly.
But, I mean, if you're not, like, all right, so you're a deep threat who doesn't play the deep ball well, then what are you?
Now, sometimes he did. And there are times where you saw him track the ball really well, but there are times
where
he didn't.
So there's the ability to do
it. There's the ability to do it. Now you're just coming into the different varying degrees of playing the ball well in the air. You know, is he good at it? Is he very good at it? Is he great at it? Is he above average at it? That's where every team is going to grade him differently. And if you're going to use him in that way as a deep threat guy, you have to feel confident in that.
So I think a lot of comparisons from Will Fuller to Deshaun Jackson. You view Deshaun Jackson as a much better all-around receiver than a Will Fuller.
And Jackson plays the ball so well in the air. Right? And that's the big – I mean, to me, that's why Jackson reminds me more of like a Corey Coleman, because Corey Coleman plays the ball so well in the air. You know, Coleman, like Laquon Treadwell actually, only ran four – you know, Treadwell ran more routes, but Corey Coleman only ran four routes in college. So that's going to be the big question with him. But he plays the ball so well in the air, tracks it really well downfield. Fuller doesn't have that.
So for those of you listening to this for fantasy, just keep this in mind. Will Fuller might be the type of guy who catches 30 balls in a season and does everything the team wants him to do. And maybe he catches 30 balls for 575 yards, 19 yards a catch, scores 5 touchdowns. That's not going to do a lot for fantasy.
I hate receivers like Will Fuller for fantasy football. Guys like Torrey Smith.
Torrey Smith.
Yeah, I never draft them because they're so infuriating.
How much fun was it to have Torrey Smith for fantasy?
Yeah, exactly right.
And that was very poor circumstances
with
San Francisco, but I can see that happening.
Yep.
You know, this is why we didn't have Devin Smith. Even you like Devin Smith more than Will Fuller, but this is why we didn't have Devin Smith ranked high for fantasy. Like, maybe he catches 20 balls and does everything they want him to do.
And that's where the difference comes between, you know, fantasy football and then how the NFL teams view these players. For an NFL team, Will Fuller's going to be pretty valuable if you see him in that way. But for a fan, you know, like you said, he might do everything right and catch, you know, 33 passes for, you know, 478 yards and 5 touchdowns.
How does he compare to a Mike Wallace? Does Mike Wallace play the ball better in the air as well?
At this point in his career, yeah, Wallace probably plays the ball better. But, you know, Wallace obviously has other issues too.
Certainly. Let's go to the tight end position before we wrap this up, Fran. And I think it's a position that we always say it's so important in the NFL these days, but the classes that have come out for college, there's maybe three or four guys maximum who you can look at and say, you know what, I view that guy as a potentially impactful NFL player. There's just a dearth of these guys. There's not a lot of big guys who move very well. And the ones who do, maybe the production isn't there. Maybe they're still learning the position. We don't really view tight ends as players you take generally in the top half of the first round. I guess Eric Ebron would be the exception to that in the last 5 or 6 years. And look at his production thus far in his NFL career. Is this a rawer position than some of the other ones coming out of college?
I think there's a couple reasons for it. One thing that I don't think is talked about nearly enough is coming out of high school, if you've got a guy, let's look at a guy like Thomas Duarte, or not even Thomas Duarte, let's look at a guy like Hunter Henry, just in terms of body type, not necessarily the prospect, but the body type. 6'4 and a half, 250 pounds, runs a 4.6. If you're a college program, you're looking at a guy that has those measurables, you're thinking, oh, man, he might be a really good defensive end.
Right.
So you see a lot of these guys get moved to the defensive side of the ball earlier in their career. And that certainly has something to do with it. The kinds of offense, the schemes the teams are running now at the college level certainly has something to do with it. It's harder to project some players, and we're going to talk about a guy who's in some ways is easy to project, in others it's a total crapshoot. And that's Thomas Duarte from UCLA.
And he's a guy you really like, though. And
I do.
But
there's questions.
He was listed as a wide receiver and a tight end at varying points of his college career.
Right.
We're viewing him as a tight end prospect, but probably not one who's going to line up in line a whole lot.
Because he never did at UCLA this past season anyway. Lined up completely in the slot. Now, here's the question. We've seen lots of tight ends come out over the last few years that didn't line up in line with their hand on the ground, and that's part of the college game now. But you look at a guy like – and the person I think of right now is Jay Samaro. Never lined up in line for Texas Tech. But when he was in the slot and he was asked to block slot corners or safeties or corners on the outside, he was dominant. He won at the point of attack and was able to do it, and the question was, okay, now can he do it with his hand on the ground against a D-end or a linebacker? Thomas Duarte didn't win those matchups. so that's a question. But if you're drafting Thomas Duarte to be a blocker at the point of attack, you're probably not doing it right. To me, you're looking at Thomas Duarte. Is he going to have to learn how to block? Absolutely, because you don't want to be one-dimensional. But athletically and from a ball skills standpoint and a route running standpoint, I was really impressed with Thomas Duarte, and everybody has made the comparison, and rightfully so. It's funny, before the combine, a lot of people made this comparison to Jordan Reed. Then he goes to the combine, and one of his number one spider graph comparisons was Jordan Reed and the way that he tested. But you have a guy that, he offers no value as a blocker, like I mentioned, and that's going to be my biggest concern with him, especially in terms of competitiveness. But he's an outstanding athlete for the tight end position. He'll be I think he can be a matchup guy in the NFL if a team uses him right. He's got outstanding hands. He runs great routes, though I wish I saw it a little bit more consistently. He's a good college route runner for the tight end spot, and he's a threat with the ball in his hands. He's going to be a really fun player to watch. It seems like teams are all over the place on him in terms of what you hear from the different insiders out there. I'm really anxious to see where he ends up in this draft because – in terms of receiving threats, to me, he's at the top of the list.
He's big, certainly.
Yeah, relative. I mean, he's 6'2", 231, so not great size, but solid size.
He never lined up in line.
Never.
And he's a terrible blocker.
Yes.
What makes him a tight end?
I think the fact that he's listed that way.
Is that it?
And he went to the combine as a tight end, and that's how he wants to be viewed. And look, he may be – I'm not there working out with him, so I have no idea. He might be working on his blocking and putting on even more weight. He was 231 at the combine. He could be 239 now, or 236 now, and hoping to be 240-ish by the time he gets to NFL training camp. But look, if you've got a guy like Thomas Duarte, and then you've got a guy like Devin Kajust from Stanford, and you have a guy like Marcus Colston from New Orleans, you may use him the same way, regardless of what position they're listed at. It's like the whole Jimmy Graham debate. Is he a receiver or a tight end? Look, he's a matchup guy in the NFL. You're going to use him in that way.
They don't
way
really have a position
in other.
So, all I'm saying is you take the name and the number off of Thomas Duarte's jersey, or you take the name and the number off Jordan Reed's jersey, what position do you think in your mind that guy's playing? Is he playing wide receiver or is he playing tight end?
Well, it comes down to how teams are going to view it when they play them, because here's where that matters.
You put a safety on him.
Exactly. That's where it matters, is when the Washington Redskins come out, when they break the huddle or they come from the sideline and they've got a running back, a fullback, and Jordan Reed on the field, are they looking at – are teams looking at that as 20 personnel with two backs and no tight ends, or 21 personnel with two backs and one tight end? And that's going to affect how they're going to play defense.
Teams might view them completely differently.
They might.
One team might treat him as a receiver, another team as a tight end.
Yeah, so then are they going to come out in nickel or are they going to come out in base? And so that means, is a linebacker going to be covering Jordan Reed, or is it going to be a slot corner, or is it going to be a safety? That's where it comes into play, more so than what meeting room the guy goes into during the week and who he practices with on a daily basis. Obviously, that has a lot to do with it. But Duarte is going to be an interesting guy to watch.
Another guy who you don't like as much as a lot of people are discussing, and I think he runs into some of the same blurry lines, if you will, as Thomas Duarte, but doesn't move as well as him, is Austin Hooper of Stanford. And I think it's very natural. Stanford has been a tight end factory of late. You mentioned Devin Cajuste, who doesn't have the hype as Austin Hooper, but he's going to come out and probably is going to be drafted. And then you look at the fact that they've churned out Zach Ertz, Kobe Fleener, Jim Dre, Levine Toilolo. These guys have come out of Stanford and have turned into varying degrees of productive players in the NFL. And I think a lot of folks think Austin Hooper is just the next in line, but you have some questions about how Austin Hooper transitions to the NFL.
Yeah, the big thing with me was coming into the year, because I watched him as a freshman, because he's a redshirt sophomore. I watched him as a freshman in 2014, and look, it was his first year playing. I wanted to see him improve as a blocker. I wanted to see him improve as a route runner. And two big things for the tight end spot. When you're playing in the middle of the field close to the ball, route running is more important even than playing as a wide receiver. You need to be able to separate quickly as a tight end if you're going to be open and be a receiving threat for the tight or for the quarterback. So for me, I wanted to see him take the next step as a route runner, and I didn't see it. He lost his starting job to a true freshman tight end and still was a factor on the offense, but did not get full-time reps as a starter tight end, a starting tight end for Stanford this year. And look, he's a good player, but my question with me with Austin Hooper is, a lot of times when I watched him run routes, he was running into defenders in the open field. I didn't think that he was the athlete that some people make him out to be. Sure, there were times where he was lined up as the ex-ISO receiver. I can remember a play against USC and Sua Cravens. Sua Cravens was lined up to the backside of a 3-by-1 over Austin Hooper. He ran a dig route, but he telegraphed it. It wasn't a good route. Cravens was all over it. It was an incomplete pass. I don't know that he's that type of athlete that's going to do that consistently and win at the next level. So if he's not that, and he's not a great blocker, and he's not a great route runner, I think teams are just going to need a little bit of patience. Whoever drafts him, I think, is going to need a little bit of patience in terms of his development.
And I think for Dynasty in fantasy, tight end is a position that requires patience anyway, because very rarely do these guys come out and have a big-time season as a rookie. So Hooper is certainly somebody, Fran, in all but maybe the deepest of dynasty drafts. I don't even know if he should be drafted depending on where he goes. And just to bring it back to the Stanford angle, how would you compare and contrast Hooper to Zach Ertz and Kobe Fleener?
Now, they were both far better prospects to me.
And they're different players themselves, sure. Ertz and Fleener.
Yeah, I mean, more athletic. Both were more athletic. Zach Ertz needed a lot of work as a blocker. Fleener, I didn't think was ever going to turn into a very good blocker, but he definitely had the athletic traits that made you have some hope there. I struggled a bit with Austin Hooper, and for a lot of the reasons we talked about in terms of his route running and because of his blocking, those are two things that are very important at the tight end position. If you're not going to be that kind of matchup guy, you need to be able to help in other situations. And right now, I don't feel confident that he's going to be able to do that right away.
So, in comparing him to Thomas Duarte, who we talked about, you just feel like Duarte is more capable of exploiting mismatches.
Yes.
Even though he might struggle even more than Hooper as a blocker, you can cast that aside because he has an elite
from
skill.
He's got a trump card. Yeah, and he's got, like, if he goes to a coaching, let's say he goes to New Orleans, let's say he comes here to Philadelphia to a guy like Doug Peterson who knows how to take advantage of matchups. You've seen what this coaching staff in Philadelphia, Doug Peterson and Frank Reich, have been able to do with the tight end position and really try and leverage those skill sets and turn it into production. A guy like a Thomas Duarte would make a lot of sense in terms of this guy could be a fantasy sleeper.
A San Diego, which just lost Ladarius Green.
Absolutely.
Maybe even L.A., which lost Jared Cook. Maybe get somebody else in there who can maybe exploit some mismatches for a new quarterback. I think these tight ends, it's always a matter of fit and how teams are going to use them. And I think everybody is always looking for the Patriots to replace he who shall not be named at the number two tight end position. Which they feel, obviously, they did with the Martellus Bennett trade. But something like that, it's going to be interesting to see how these guys transition.
Yeah, it's always – because you look at a guy why am I struggling to remember his name? But the tight end from Iowa who went to the Houston Texans a couple years ago.
C.J. Fedorowicz?
Yes, Fedorowicz. I loved C.J. Fedorowicz. And a guy that knew how to block. He could get down the seam. He had good hands. He knew how to run routes. Everything seemed like it translated, but he just hasn't been able to put it together. He hasn't been a big part of the offense. If he goes to another team and they're throwing the ball, if he gets 150 targets in a season, now you're talking maybe he's something else, And so it's very much a situation by situation case. That's why I'm very wary about the tight ends that I draft in fantasy football.
And if you want to learn more about all of these guys and plenty more, over 60 guys, we broke it down at fantasyguru.com. Just go there for a pre-draft rookie report. It is free if you don't even subscribe to the site and you just want to get a taste of what we offer at fantasyguru.com. You can go there and read the pre-draft rookie report. And most importantly, if you want to hear more from Fran, visit philadelphiaeagles.com. Download the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. Download the Journey to the Draft podcast. Download the College Draft podcast with Ross Tucker. All of these available on iTunes. Follow Fran on Twitter at FDuffy3. He is Fran Duffy, the video content manager of PhiladelphiaEagles.com. I was very lucky to have him. Hope you enjoyed him. Fran, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks, Joe.
And this is Joe Dolan. I'm the managing editor of FantasyGuru.com. I am signing off. Enjoy the NFL draft, everyone. We'll be back very soon.